current state on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back. We're glad you're along. We're planning a busy week here on the program. We have State of the Union and State of the City addresses scheduled for this week. Congressman Mike Rogers responds Wednesday morning to the State of the Union address here on Current State. We look forward to that. On Friday morning, Lansing City Council President Aileen Bowles and her City Council colleague Carol Wood respond to Lansing Mayor Virge Bernero's State of the City address. We'll learn more about the expansion of Mid-Michigan's Rails to Trails program. Richard McClellan, State Rep Andy Shore, Tim Skubick joins us on Thursday. Busy week already taking shape. In his recent State of the State address, Governor Rick Snyder said the federal government needs to take note of a few things Michigan knows how to do.
We can say it about tax reform. We can say it about paying our long-term debt. We can say it about balanced budgets. But I am making a request here tonight because it involves you, the legislators, both the House and the Senate, that I ask you to take up the issue of doing a resolution asking the United States government to include in the United States Constitution an amendment to say they have to balance their budget.
In fact, the Michigan Senate already agreed to such a proposal last November. Last week, the Michigan House began debate on it. If and when 34 states pass such measures, it would mandate that the federal budget be balanced. The idea, which has come very close to passing the Congress at least once before, has generated a good deal of national discussion for many years. Joining us to discuss what he feels are the merits of adding Michigan's voice to this call for a constitutionally balanced budget is the sponsor of the Senate proposal. We welcome Senator Mike Green of Mayville, Michigan. Senator Green, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be on this morning.
Explain to us why you support Michigan getting behind the call for a constitutional balanced budget amendment.
Well, there's a lot of reasons. Number one, the reason is federal government is spending us debt-wise into oblivion. I don't think anybody anywhere will disagree with the fact that we are spending way out of what we can afford to spend. I think a lot of the debate will be centered around, we can't have a balanced budget amendment because we won't be able to pay the things that we're used to getting. Well, that's a pretty good reason, because a lot of the things we're used to getting, we can't afford. Just like anybody else, the state or even each one of us, if our expenses exceed our revenue, we can't just keep spending. Well, you know, some people say, well, it's a credit card that we can just keep spending up to our unlimited. Well, I disagree with that too, because you cannot overspend what your income is. And the federal government's been doing it for a number of years. And at some point, we've got to stop.
What are your projections in terms of being able to pay off the national debt with a balanced budget amendment? Have you looked at how long that would take?
Well, I'm not sure that we're already way past what we can do already. There is a limit to what you can expect reasonably for us to pay back without raising taxes. We are in a position now where we're over $17.4 trillion in debt. We're exceeding our revenue by a number of trillion dollars every year. And even if we stop spending, I'm not sure how long it would take, which we're not going to do. It would depend on how long it would take to pay this debt back. And, you know, I think we need to take reasonable steps today to try and curb what we're doing and what we project in the future to be.
Now, critics of austerity point both to various studies and to very recent experiences of countries like Britain and others, and claim that economic growth becomes a lot harder by cutting than through stimulus. They point to the eradication of the national debt about 15 years or so ago due to the surge in high tech in the country. What's wrong with that interpretation?
Well, again, I'm not an economist. There are a lot of economists that's been looking at this, making projections and saying, well, this and that, if we borrow more money and spend, it creates an incentive for us to get out and earn more money, which creates more taxes. But just look at what's happened in America in the last 5 years, where we had that major downturn in our economy, and we've really never, ever pulled out of it yet, and the government keeps right on spending. And so I maintain that's not the answer. I have yet to figure out why the people in Congress, the Senate, and the House continues to do this and never, ever give a reason for it. I mean, this debate's been going on for a number of years, but yet Congress will not come out and say, well, we can keep spending because of this, or we can keep spending because of that. Well, I don't believe that's true. I don't believe there's a good answer. I think the answer is, how do we stop spending to balance our revenues and our expenditures? And I think that's the prudent way to do it.
What will be, if the Michigan legislature passes this measure, how would it work then? What actually happens after the legislature passes this?
Okay, once the House passes my Senate House joint resolution, which I expect them to do it at least this week and at the latest next week, a message will be sent to Congress that says Michigan has passed this resolution for a call to a convention. And once Congress gets 34 of these states to do it, they were required by the Constitution to set a time and a date to hold the convention. Notices will be sent out to all the states to send representatives from their local states to debate how the amendment will look, and then we'll proceed from there. Once it's established what the amendment will include, then it'll be sent back to all 50 states, and then 38 of the 50 states will have to pass the resolution. Then it will become part of our Constitution.
I have to ask you about the flexibility in times of national emergency or a severe economic recession or war. Would the Congress be able to act in a timely manner if their hands were essentially tied by the Constitution?
Yeah, within the amendment, there will be different scenarios set forth that will be part of the amendment. We've already had discussions about it, and we really expect that to be a part of the amendment in emergencies, in times of wars. And there'll be parameters set up to determine that, and then Congress would be able to overspend in order to take care of the emergencies or time of war. We don't know. I don't think anybody that's been involved in this whole process wants to hamstring the things that we're doing that are good or that we need or that we have to have. I think what we want to do is say, hey, look, there's a bunch of stuff that you're irresponsible in your spending ways, and you need to look at everything and every way you spend your money and justify it, whether it's reasonable or not, as you and I would do when we balance our budget.
Michigan obviously benefited from the, well, many people feel that Michigan benefited from the automobile bailout that came from the federal government. That likely would not have happened under this scenario. What's your take on that? Would the federal government be prohibited, essentially, from lending assistance like that in such a dire situation?
Well, you know, Michigan balances our budget every year, and we also accumulate some debt, but it's structured debt where there's a plan to pay it off. And we have within ourselves the ability to borrow that money because we have a good credit rating. And no one, I'm not sure how the amendment will finally come out, but I think there will be some things involved in it that will allow the federal government to have some debt, but I can't tell you that either. I think we're at a point where we have to structure our government up so it can pay its bills. And again, it'll be representatives from 50 states that'll determine what goes into that amendment to allow federal government to operate, but yet also be able to pay their bills.
Any thoughts, Senator Green, on what would happen to federal entitlement programs like Social Security and Medicare under a balanced budget amendment?
I can't speculate. But the problem with Social Security and Medicare is the fact that we've robbed the money from those trust funds to pay for other things that those people feel are more important.
But do you think Social Security and Medicare would remain intact, or?
I don't know. All those smart people down there we sent there that have spent us into oblivion will now have to look at everything that we're spending our money on and determine what's important and what isn't important. You know, the federal government today could shut off Social Security. There's a lot of things they could do today that they're not. There's also ways that they could balance the budget that they're not doing. And so what this is going to do is say to Congress, you figure out what's important and spend the money on that. You figure out what is not important and quit spending. And I think that's a reasonable thing to expect Congress to do. You know, really what all Congress does is they see a problem and they reach back in this big bucket of money and grab a handful of it and throw it at the problem with never, ever reassessing the programs they've been spending money on for years and years and years or whether we still need to do it or not. We just keep adding to the spending levels. And I think this year will put Congress on notice that now you got to look at what you're spending your money on and justify it, not just keep spending.
We want to thank Senator Mike Green of Mayville, Michigan. He is a supporter of adding Michigan's voice to the call for a constitutionally balanced budget. Senator Green, thank you.
Thank you very much for listening this morning.
Appreciate it. Well, for another take on the proposal for a balanced budget amendment here, we're joined by MSU Professor of Economics, Charlie Ballard. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, Mark. How are you?
It's not that hard to understand where proponents of the balanced budget amendment are coming from. The federal deficit is $17 trillion and counting. Many on the right view amending the Constitution is the only way to rein in federal spending, given recent history. But you and many others contend there would be negative consequences. Walk us through why you think a balanced budget amendment's a bad idea.
So if you have a recession, what happens? Let's say you have a recession and you start with a balanced budget. If you have a recession, people lose their jobs. If you lose your job, you don't pay nearly as much in taxes. In fact, in terms of the federal taxes, your federal taxes would go almost to zero if you lose your job. Mm-hmm. That would mean that all else equal, the federal budget deficit would go up because there's less tax revenue coming in. Also, when people lose their jobs, they're eligible for unemployment compensation and for other things. That, all else equal, would push up the federal budget deficit. And that's actually a good thing for stabilizing the economy when there's a downturn. Because if you insisted on putting the economy into a straitjacket by balancing the budget in every single year, what would happen? Well, you'd have to raise taxes on everybody else, or you'd have to cut. And, you know, Senator Green said that we could shut off Social Security. That's an exact quote from 2 minutes ago. We could do that. But then what would happen to the elderly folks who lost their check? They would spend less. They would not be able to buy as much groceries. They would not be able to do all the things that they do. Then all the merchants who receive money from those folks would have less coming into their cash register. Some of those businesses would go out of business. They would lay off workers. Then you get what this kind of ripple effect, this ongoing multiplier. And what that means is that if you insist on balancing the budget during a recession or a depression, you make that recession into a depression or you make that depression worse. We've got lots of historical examples from that.
Some of them going on right now, it seems to me.
Well, that's right.
Britain.
Now, let me be very clear. I don't want people to lampoon me as saying, oh, I want the federal budget to just spend without limit and I don't care any about deficits. Of course I care. But sometimes the medicine is worse than the disease. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to pass into the Constitution of the United States something that says that we must turn a recession into a depression. I don't think that's good policy.
One of the ongoing topics related to this is the fact that we stand to, over the longer haul, reduce the deficit more effectively and more dramatically by encouraging growth now through more stimulus than through austerity. Can you just walk us through that argument?
As I just suggested, if you slam on the brakes by raising taxes and cutting spending during a recession, that actually makes the recession worse. And then that throws more people out of work, and at least for a time, that can make your budget deficit worse. Now, most economists would say we don't want to have big deficits every period. Of course not. A reasonable goal would be to balance the budget over the business cycle, where you have surpluses in good times, but then you have the flexibility to run deficits when there's a recession. I want to get back to one thing that both you and Senator Green said about controlling spending. The implication there is that the reason that we have deficits is that our spending is out of control. Federal government spends less than the federal government of any other rich country. What we had is in 1997 through 2000, we had a balanced budget. Mm-hmm. Federal budget was balanced. And then we cut taxes. The tax cuts passed in 2001.
And went to war.
Those tax cuts were the big reason for the deficits in the early part of the 21st century. We didn't have huge spending increases. We did have some because we went to war. But the big cause was tax cuts. And so we have to look at that in balance. It's not just spending. It's do you raise enough taxes to cover your spending? And in the United States for the last 40 years, we've had a difficult political debate. Senator Green, I think, would balance the budget by only spending cuts. But there are others who would say, hey, let's not shut off Social Security. And in fact, surveys show that a vast majority of Americans want there to be higher taxes on high-income people. So it's both sides of the ledger.
How do you see the entitlement situation playing out?
Well, we have committed in the United States.
Popular programs.
I think we've established
that.
Yeah. Social Security especially. And yet we've promised more in Social Security payments than we're likely to be able to pay under current projections. That means that either you've got to raise taxes or you've got to cut some benefits or some combination of the two. My guess is that eventually Social Security will be brought into long-run balance by some combination of raising the ceiling on payroll tax contributions. That's one partial thing. We might have a further raise in the retirement
age.
There's dozens of little ways in which you could address a part of the problem, and you could do so in such a way as to add up to balancing the Social Security. Same situation for Medicare, although the Medicare funding situation is more severe. We're going to have to clamp down more on Medicare spending or raise taxes more in order to achieve balance there.
Another common topic is tax loopholes and the revenue that may be contained in those. Do you see tax reform as a encouraging way to shore up the deficit?
Oh, absolutely. Now, of course, every tax loophole has an army of lawyers and lobbyists in Brooks Brothers suits who want to fight hard for
right. It.
But, you know, this is something that tax economists and political leaders have been talking about for years. And, in fact, a couple of years ago, most of the reports are that Speaker Boehner and President Obama came close to the so-called grand bargain, under which we would make both tax reforms, which would include closing some of those tax preferences, and some long-run reforms to entitlements. It can be done. What's missing here is the political will to do it. But I don't think that imposing political will by a balanced budget amendment, which says that you guarantee that the next recession will be much, much worse, I don't think that's the right way to go about it.
Senator Green talked about different scenarios, though, where exceptions would be allowed.
And the current language in the joint resolution, as I read it, does call for exceptions in the case of a national emergency. If there were enough exceptions, for war and for recession and the aftermath of recession, it might be possible to have such an amendment that wouldn't do such profound damage. Although, if you make enough exceptions that it wouldn't do profound damage, pretty soon you don't have the amendment at all. I would prefer to not have such an amendment, not hamstring the policy process, and we need to get people to vote for members of Congress who will be willing to do the unpopular things, which is to make modest cuts in spending and to make increases in taxes.
We've seen a rather bumpy start economically here in 2014. I think the forecast for the year as a whole might still be generally positive in terms of growing the U.S. economy, but we're seeing what a lot of people consider to be the beginning of a correction. Any thoughts on that?
Well, the Federal Reserve's policy of injecting a tremendous amount of liquidity into the system by buying bonds, one of the side effects of that is that it pumps up the stock market. Now, we've known for years that the Fed couldn't continue to buy $85 billion of bonds every year. And so they've already begun to taper that. They'll probably continue. But I think we're likely to be able to withstand a stock market correction.
Okay. Professor Charlie Ballard, economics professor here at Michigan State University, with his thoughts on the balanced budget amendment. Thank you, Charlie.
Thank you, Mark.
Current state on WKAR. Why do we need sleep anyway? Well, maybe this isn't a great question to ask on a Monday morning, but some new research indicates that sleep may actually be what enables the brain's cleaning crew to keep things chemically tidy in there. A Danish study published this fall in the journal Science has implications both for our daily mental well-being and possibly for longer-term concerns like dementia and Alzheimer's disease. And to get a better idea of the findings, current state's Melissa Benmark spoke with a Dr. Peter Todd about this issue. It sounds fascinating.
It really is. It sounds like a groundbreaking study just in terms of what we understand about the brain and the function of sleep. And Dr. Todd is an assistant professor in the Department of Neurology at the University of Michigan. And what he started out with was explaining what up until now the scientific community has traditionally thought actually happened in our brains while we were asleep.
The purpose of sleep is one of the great mysteries of science. If you think about it from an evolutionary perspective, sleep is probably a bad idea. So falling asleep in the woods puts you at risk for being eaten by a bear or some other creature. And we know that sleep is required across really a wide variety of species, everything from flies and worms up to man. And if you don't get sleep, then that's actually lethal. It's not survivable. So the ideas about what sleep was doing based on that were unclear. Some people thought it was about decreasing your chance of being out in dangerous environments. Some people thought it was about, we've known for a long time that you need to be able to sleep to form and consolidate some new memories, and that there are some changes in the brain that happen during sleep. But a lot of, beyond that, I think there's really been a bit of a black box about what sleep's major purpose is.
The Danish biologist who led this study had postulated that the brain actually had kind of its own equivalent of the body's lymph system, some channels of liquids that cleared out the toxins left over from the day's brain activity. But she couldn't really check on that. In fact, the article I read said that they've been thinking that this might be the case for about 100 years. Couldn't really check until there was a way to see inside the brain. Talk a little bit about the technology that enables us to see fluid movement, in this case, a mouse brain.
Yeah, this is a really fascinating study that was done. So they utilized two techniques that are a little different than has been done in the past. So first, they use a system where they can actually make a small they basically shave down the skull to make it very, very thin. They can use a microscope that can actually see through that very thin skull layer into the brain tissue. And then they use a dye that they can inject into the space around the neurons in the brain. And then they can track the movement of that dye using this fancy microscope called a two-photon microscope. Using this sort of combination of things, they were able to look at the flow of the extracellular fluid that exists around the brain. So most of the brain is made up of neurons and other cells, the things that we think about as doing all the communication and thinking in the brain. And then in the space around these cells, there is a fluid that flows around, an extracellular fluid. So they were able to use these techniques to then image that extracellular fluid moving within space and determine whether it was moving at the same pace when the animals were asleep or awake.
And so this interstitial space kind of opens up when they're asleep?
I guess the best way I could think of explaining it would be like Mardi Gras in New Orleans. So if you were on Bourbon Street at night during Mardi Gras, the streets would be filled with activity. And really, even if you wanted to walk around the streets, it would be very difficult to do so because there's so many people and you'd be bumping up against everybody. And so when much like that in the brain, the neurons in the brain are very active. And when they're active, they actually swell a little bit. They're a little bit larger. And so it literally fills up those spaces and the streets get narrower. At the same time, if you were trying to clean up the trash that's being thrown down during the Mardi Gras parade while the parade was happening, you would have a hard time making much of a dent because it would be very hard for the cleaning supplies to get to where they needed to. But the next morning after everybody's gone to sleep, the amount of activity in the streets has dropped dramatically, and the ability of the cleaning staff to get in to actually clean up the mess is much greater. And the same thing happens in the brain. When you go to sleep, there's less neuronal activity. And when the neurons are less active, they're smaller. And when they're smaller, there's more space around them for this fluid to flow. And like a river, that allows it to just flow at a much more rapid pace and allows the clearance mechanisms for getting rid of these toxic buildup of products is much more efficient.
Is this as radical as it sounds to me? I mean, it's like you like discovering a whole new set of blood vessels or something in your body.
Well, so we've known that this kind of system is in place elsewhere in the body. So there's a system in the rest of the body known as the lymphatic system. And so when blood flows from your heart out into, say, your muscle or other organs, some of the fluid from the blood leaks out into that fluid space, into the extracellular space. And there's always been a need by the body to get rid of that and clear it by a different way. And that's a system called the lymphatic system. So maybe many people know what lymph nodes are, those nodes that swell in your neck when you get sick.
Right.
And so that's part of a way to sort of retrieve that extra cellular fluid and also a way to get rid of extra junk that builds up in those tissues that you can't get to with a closed system like blood vessels. And so the working model of what was going on in the brain before this study was that there were actually mechanisms in place within the cells in the brain to sort of recycle locally these products. But there has been suggestions of this kind of idea that there is something like the lymphatic system in the brain that have dated back a long time. So that idea itself is not novel, but nobody's really found a good way to test for its existence and understand its major roles.
So given that many, many of us have sleep deprivation, what happens to our cognitive functioning in the short term if we are not essentially getting the street sweepers in overnight?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've known for a long time that cognitive performance in the setting of acute sleep deprivation is worse, and significantly worse. And to be honest, this is, in the medical community, this is one of the reasons that we've changed the way we have medical residents do their care.
I wondered about that.
It used to be, and I was one of those doctors that would stay up for 36 hours in a row taking care of patients. And I can tell you from personal experience that, you know, the next day after having not slept all night, you're simply not as smart. You can't, you have to, you know, we would often make sure that we had somebody double check everything we were doing because our chances of making a significant error were much higher in those settings. And so, we've known that that's true, that you actually are by testing, not as smart or not as quick in the setting of sleep deprivation. But so I think for the acute effects, this could reflect some of that. But I think the bigger repercussions are about questions related to chronic sleep deprivation. So we in America sleep probably an hour less than we used to 20 or 30 years ago, and even less than that compared to people 100 years ago. And so there's a question about what the long-term repercussions of chronic sleep deprivation or chronic poor sleep would have on people in terms of their ability to clear metabolites from the brain. The evidence for those is less strong than it is for the acute effects, where it's pretty clear. But I think it's a field that's sort of growing in terms of interest.
I've also read that some of the brain's leftover waste is associated with Alzheimer's and dementia later in life. Are there potential long-term effects when people don't get enough sleep? And does this study kind of point toward that?
The short answer is that the studies we have in people are not as clear as this study that was performed here in a mouse model. There's been a number of studies dating back before this. We've known that the Alzheimer's protein, which gets broken down into a small piece of a protein called A-beta, accumulates in the space between cells in the brain, and that accumulation of this protein into aggregates in the brain called plaques is associated with Alzheimer's disease and associated with memory problems, both in animal models and in people. And so we've known for a while that actually where that A-beta protein gets produced directly correlates with where these aggregates or plaques build up in the brain, and that the relative levels of that protein fluctuate with sleep and wake and fluctuate with brain activity. And so that's been known for a while, for probably 5 or 6 years. And really, the finding in this study is that up until now, we've been thinking about that entirely on the production end. We've been thinking about it as though this A-beta protein is being overproduced when you're awake and then decreased production when you're asleep. And mm-hmm. There's pretty good evidence that that does happen.
Mm-hmm.
But this now sort of looks at the other side of that, the clearance of this protein. And I think that it does suggest that enhancing clearance of the protein might be an effective therapeutic target in people who are at risk for Alzheimer's disease or have Alzheimer's disease. With that said, the studies we have in patients, looking at patients who have significant sleep problems or looking at patients that have things like obstructive sleep apnea that lead to poor sleep, don't necessarily show as strong of a correlation with the eventual development of Alzheimer's disease as you would expect if this was the primary cause of the condition.
Well, thank you for helping us to understand this study a little bit better. And Dr. Peter Todd, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.
Making a movie is a complicated business. There has to be a script, a producer, a director, actors, costumes, sets, props, and a seemingly endless list of jobs to be done. If you've ever watched a movie through the end of the credits, you know what I mean. Today, Current State launches an ambitious project to follow the process of making a movie in Michigan from start to finish. And our Scott Pohl joins me with the first installment of a series we're calling Movie Making in Michigan. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Mark.
Give us some of the basics of how movie making in Michigan, this project is going to play out.
Well, the way I've described this to people is like this. I'm going to be with this group of people from start to finish on this project. And here's what I mean by to the finish. The finish could be we've run out of money, it peters out, and the movie never gets made. Or if the final step is Hollywood and they're collecting their Oscars. These people are going to let me follow them every step of the way
cool. In
making this movie. And that includes all sorts of things. You mentioned a few jobs in the introduction, but things like the writing, the casting, choosing sets and locales, the music, editing the movie, maybe the festival circuit, and probably the most important step of the process is the whole issue of raising enough money to actually get started. So I'll be along with them every step of the way. These are veteran independent filmmakers who know what can go wrong in a project like this. So they're prepared to deal with any obstacles they might encounter, too.
What's the movie about?
Well, as you might imagine, they don't want me to give too much away. They don't want future viewers of the movie to hear spoilers. They want people to enjoy the movie when and if and when, I should say, I suppose, if and when the movie comes out. I can tell you basically that it's about the struggles of a retired boxer.
And who are we going to meet in this first installment then?
Well, I talked with Rich Gotiri. This movie was his idea. He wrote it. He rewrote it with a writing partner. He put the team together. And Rich is also planning to play the struggling retired boxer in the movie. So he's also an actor. He told me that he got the idea for the story while working for a while at a Detroit market.
It was. It was my idea. I came here to visit some friends for a couple of weeks, and I realized that they had to work during the day, so what was I going to do? And my buddy said, well, come work with me. So I went to work with him at the market, and, you know, those guys start work at 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning. And I did that for almost 3 weeks straight. And then when I came back here to Detroit to work for Second City, I actually worked with them for 3 months to research the movie.
Has it been your intention from the start that you would play the lead?
It was. I wrote the vehicle for myself, and my literary agent read the movie, the script, the first version, and had someone want to option the movie, which means that they pay you and they try to raise money. And in 90 days, they either give you the script back or you get to keep the money and get the script back, both of those things. And so we optioned it, and I cashed the check, and I shouldn't have done that. I shouldn't have gave them that option. So I kind of prayed that they wouldn't sell it, and they didn't. So we got it back, and I vowed never to do it again. And two other people wanted to option the movie, but I said no.
Who might be your inspiration for not only writing a movie, but hoping to play the lead yourself? There's a lot not to like about this character.
There is a lot not to like. He's obnoxious at times, and he's very angry. And I think that's just because he has a lot of pain. And I think that he's likable also just as much, and I think at the end we see that a lot of this is coming from his past and his parents, and the drinking is inherited, I think, in his case. You root from him almost from, let's say, 20 pages in, you start rooting for him slowly, 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 and it builds to liking him. So that was the goal.
I don't want to give too much away about the story, but I guess what I might ask you to do is look ahead 5 years when there's the one or two sentence description and TV guide for this movie. Tell our listeners what the story of this project is.
Two brothers, through very tough times, find the true meaning of life, love and family.
Well, you did that great. I'm going to save that for TV Guide.
I just made it up. I don't know. I'm sweating thinking about it. But I think that's really what it comes down to, you know, family, love, and what life's really about. You know, I think we all want millions of dollars in the back of our minds or to be financially set, and that's wonderful. But, you know, it really doesn't come down to that. It comes to the people in your lives, the experiences you have. So I think at the end of our lives, the things we'll really truly have as the line there is experiences. You know, not money. It's not going to do you any good.
Now, you wrote this how long ago?
I first wrote my first draft in 97. And, that's when we optioned it in 98. And I've been holding on to it since then. And my writing partner, I brought Mike Malai in, my writing partner. We've written, around 10 scripts together. We're in pre-production for a movie right now called The Italy Boys, Christopher Walken. And I said, Mike, let's do a rewrite together on this. So that's why I brought Mike in. So the last rewrite was, I believe, October 25th, 2012.
Is it one of those things that you hear about it sat in a drawer for a period of time?
It did. It just sat there. It just sat there. And it wasn't the right time. Back in 98, it was really hard to make a movie yourself. Now it's a little easier with video and things of that nature. So I think it was for a reason that it sat there.
And maybe you were too young for the character back then.
I was just thinking that as you said that. That's funny that you said that. I think it clicked in our heads at the same time. Yeah, I think now, being older, I've experienced more and I understand more about people. So, yeah, I think it definitely made the last draft that we did. I definitely couldn't have wrote it in 98.
In terms of the nuts and bolts of getting a movie made, am I missing a step there between the time that you wrote the script and where we are today? Is there anything I'm missing there? Because it's simple to think, script, call some people in and read it. I'm sure there's more to it that I've missed there in the last year or so.
I think what's happened is, like you said, time was, it was the right timing. Pat Moog, who's directing the feature, has directed three or four features right now. Richard Jewell has produced two or three things. It just seemed like now was the right time. We all just came together. And we've worked together before in different capacities. And I said to them, you know, I just wanted you guys to look at the script. And Pat loved it. Richard loved it. And then that's how it all came about again, you know. But in the back of my mind, it was always there to do.
Now, I sat through a read-through today with some actors who were brought in. Yeah. Some maybe will be cast. Some maybe will not. Right. What did you learn today?
The thing I learned the most, because I never heard it read before, my own performance or anybody else's, was I knew the drama was there and the intensity and the anger was there, but would the comedy come through? And they did a great job and the comedy came through. So that was my big thing, that the comedy came through.
All right, so what's next?
Next for us will be, we're meeting with our director tomorrow. He has notes for us, possibly changing some things. Instead of a boxer, making him a football player, an ex-football player. Just some changes, and we'll start rewriting again. And once we rewrite, we'll have another reading. And at the same time, once that's rewritten and he approves of it, and Richard approves, and we all approve on the script, then we'll try and raise some money.
That was going to be my next question, was money. Money being paramount in making a movie. Has any money been raised? Where are you in that process?
Well, I wish Paramount would make the movie. No, we haven't tried yet, because you really have to have a polished script. And that's what we're doing now, is we're polishing the script. So once we have the polished script, we have a list of people that we'd like to approach. And I don't know if we'll do a read for them all in one room, or we'll get it to them individually, but that'll be the next step.
Am I correct that there are people, aside from yourself, who are already involved in this project, committed to this project, who haven't been paid, have no idea when they're going to get paid or if they're ever going to get paid?
That is everyone involved in the project. None of us know about getting. We do know if we make the movie, when we make the movie, we will get paid, you know, through the Writers Guild, through the Screen Actors Guild. Producers will get money back. But we, right now, it's, you are so at the first stages of it. So it's exciting to see where we're going to go.
In terms of independent filmmaking, how typical is this?
I think it's very typical, especially in the state of Michigan. We're trying to get tax incentive money also, which will help us here in Michigan. It's like I said, in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, you know, there was no video, still film. So now that everybody's making a movie, but the question is, you know, still making a quality film, and that's what we're trying to do.
Now, as we have gotten into starting this process, I want to make it clear to our listeners that you and I, indirectly through Richard Jewell, are committed to following this story from start to finish, wherever that leads us, wherever the finish might be. And the way I've been telling people about this project is that if the finish is that it blows up and never gets made, then that's our last installment. If the finish is the Kodak Theater and accepting your Oscars, we're going to go there with you, right?
Yeah, I hope to see you in Los Angeles.
Wouldn't that be fun?
That would be amazing. It really would. We're so appreciative to you for what you're doing, because I don't think it's ever been done. I mean, I truly don't. And I know I love listening to your station, and this is the kind of stuff I love it for. Having the guts to do something totally different. And even my director and my producers, I mean, we might not make it. And I'm not trying to be negative. I'm just trying to be a realist. We're going to try. We want to make it, and I think we will make it. But, I mean, we're all putting it on the line there, because if we don't make it, you know, we don't look great, but we tried.
Well, we have lots of steps in between here and Oscars Sunday. and so I'm going to mention a few that I'm sure would be part of the process, and perhaps you can fill in others that I'll be leaving out. There's fundraising, there's casting, there's
location
searches, there's editing, music, I suppose, might be part of this, and with your help, we'll be there at every step.
Well, we appreciate that so much, and yeah, there's so much involved. I mean, even we have to get lawyers involved, and we have to get agreements, and we have to get an LLC. So there's so many steps involved, and I'm sure there'll be more, actually.
I left one important one out, and that is being on the set.
Being on set is the greatest feeling in the world, especially, I've worked with Pat before and Richard before, and we have a lot of flexibility there to improvise and go off book, and since Mike and I are on set as writers, we can change things right there. We don't have to wait for a writer or depend on another writer. We'll be there, so that'll save a lot of time, too, and money.
Rich Gotiri, thank you so much, and good luck with this movie-making project in Michigan.
Thank you so much.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
Well, this sounds like a fun project, Scott. What's next?
Well, in our next installment, I'll introduce you to Patrick Moog. He's going to direct this movie.
Look forward to it.
Thanks.
You.
Sure.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR, composer Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart will be celebrated tonight at 7:30 at MSU's Fairchild Theater as the College of Music presents its annual Happy Birthday Mozart concert. Woodwind musicians will perform several of Mozart's chamber works, and faculty vocalists will sing arias from three of Mozart's best-known operas, Don Giovanni, The Marriage of Figaro, and Così fan tutti. College of Music professor Marcy Ray will be the concert guide at tonight's Happy Birthday Mozart celebration, providing commentary and insight on Mozart and his librettist, Lorenzo De Ponte. WKAR's Peter Worf joined Professor Ray in her office late last week to preview tonight's concert.
The story of Don Giovanni had been a farce its entire history. Okay, it had been around for at least 150 years. By the time it got into Mozart and De Ponte's hands, it had always been a farce. So, of course, that's how De Ponte is writing it. And Mozart had already written some of the music, and he wrote it in this really gothic, tragic style. And so they actually had a fight about this. Mozart's like, no, this is a tragic story. This is horrifying. Of course, De Ponte's like, no, it's always been a farce, it's a comedy. So they finally agreed to combine the two elements. And so I think that it's actually approaching some of the gothic that we end up getting in the 19th century with vampires and, you know, Dracula and all this sort of stuff, mummies and whatnot, that there's a lot of the gothic in this, that like we're looking back to our past, the commendatore who comes as the ghost to dinner to say, you know, you must repent for your sins, is that sort of gothic revenant asking us to think about our past. So it's an incredible transitional work where it shows us a lot about comic opera. It shows us a lot about musical rhetoric for serious drama, but it also tells us a lot about that moment, mm-hmm. how it was transitioning from sort of lighthearted comedies for rich people and these deeply troubling images for that period around the French Revolution.
And one of De Ponte's great talents must have been in working with Mozart to help him blend or maybe even reconcile these two sides to humanity and to his own style.
Absolutely. And there's even a lot in the text that can tell us about character. So, for instance, you know a lot about a character's class from the text that they get. How is it? Is it elegant? Is it refined? Is it graceful? Is it reflective? Those kinds of characteristics are always for your upper class characters. You'll mm-hmm. never have a lower class character really reflective about emotion or sort of universal truths. What you'll have instead is a lot of text. So, Gilbert and Sullivan did a nice job with this in Pirates of Penzance. I am the very modern, I'm a modern, you know, brrr, all that kind of stuff. And it's because their speech is not elegant, it's not studied, it seems spontaneous, and also it's very busy, which of course servants are always supposed to be busy. They don't have that kind of leisured lifestyle, so they don't have time to reflect on universal truth. So you can even hear that in the text, and he makes it perfectly clear.
And what's busier than in music than that final scene of Don Giovanni with, how many fugues are going at once?
Thank you. Right. Yeah. No. And it's actually Don Giovanni is incredibly rich in terms of doing. It's intellectual. So fugues is thought to be like the highest art for a composer. So he combines that. In the dinner scene, he combines music from some of his contemporaries as well as his own other operas. He's alluding to that. I mean, he was just like he signifies such a rich amount of his musical culture, and he does this in the big ball scene where he's got a minuet going and a contradance going all at the same time to signify the different classes that are dancing and their gestures and who they are. I know that for many of us who love Mozart, Don Giovanni is kind of a pinnacle experience where all his art seems to be laid bare.
That's right. He takes some of his own dance tunes and they collide in almost sort of a pre-Ivesian way in this scene. It's incredible.
Absolutely. And it's perfect for that historical moment when we're about to get to, we've got the American Revolution, we've got the French Revolution, where indeed literally cultures and classes are colliding, and he's showing that to us in these particular scenes.
I'm talking with Dr. Marcy Ray from the Michigan State University College of Music about the Happy Birthday Mozart concert. Mozart is considered a composer by many who is unsurpassed as an opera composer on so many levels that you're talking about right now. But we do have to make a nod to instrumental music. It is, after all, a Mozart birthday concert, and we are celebrating a wide array of his life and work. But we begin the overture to the concert with one of his last works, and this is an arrangement of one of his final operas, The Magic Flute.
Yeah, so with this one, I think a lot of people have enjoyed some recent or, some interpretations of this work as being somehow revelatory of his association with the Freemasons. Yeah. And so they'll see in it like, okay, there are three flats and there are three chords in the beginning and then, they'll see all these symbols or whatever. And indeed, those might be there. I think in more recent times, we've discovered that there's just a much greater indebtedness to the fairy tale with this, which I think if you know any fairy tales, you'll realize that there are, in fact, some greater connections. But I think especially with the recent sort of Da Vinci Code interest, that we love looking for symbols and things that it can tell us about our past. And so that's one of the fun things, I think, about that overture, is that it does seem to exemplify everything that we're looking for in terms of Masonic, symbols. But the story itself, I think, is much more clearly indebted to the fairy tale.
Marcy Ray is assistant professor of music at the College of Music at Michigan State University. She will be your concert host at the Happy Birthday Mozart concert Monday night at Fairchild Theater at MSU. Professor Ray, thanks so much.
Thank you.
For Current State, this is Peter Roth.
And keep in mind that performance will also be broadcast live here on 90.5 FM. That's our show for today. Coming up Tuesday on Current State, a closer look at Governor Rick Snyder's immigration proposal. Also, journalist Gary Wilson joins us for Great Lakes Month in Review. All that and more tomorrow here on Current State. Our executive producer is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is Current State's producer. Thanks also to producers Kevin Lavery, Melissa Benmark, Emmanuel Berry, and Scott Pohl, as well as to Aaron Young for engineering and Hannah Michael John for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for listening. It's Current State on WKAR.